Ja, herzlich willkommen.
Welcome back.
This
is the last
Mirror Talk. Sie die Möglichkeit hatten an einem der früheren
I don't know whether you could participate in one of the earlier
das ist tatsächlich ein experimentelles Format.
Dialogues. Wir wollten, the format is an experimental one.
Zwei Personen von unterschiedlichen
we
Seiten
wanted
über den
to have two
reden.
Persons talk about war from different perspectives. What happens
aus zwei verschiedenen Seiten
if you talk about the
und,
war?
Ich bin sehr, sehr froh,
a scene
wir,
from two sides,
ist,
and I'm very happy to have Karl Malantes here in Berlin today. As you might know,
Teilnehmer des Vietnamkriegs
he
und
is a US-American participant in the Vietnam War, and he's also a writer. He
Matterhorn
published a book in 2010, which is called Matterhorn. That's the English title. It's a war novel. It's about Vietnam. Was then also translated into German quickly, and he also published a second book, as if he had known that we were about to talk about how to talk about war. The book was published in a German version in 2013. And I'm also happy to welcome Vietan Nguyen, born in Vietnam. He went to the United States in 2005. He's an author and he's also a lecturer at the University of Southern California. And the floor is yours.
Well, thank you so much for having us, and thank you to all of you for coming here on a Saturday night, sharing your precious time with us. Carl and I have talked extensively before this evening, and we agreed that what we're going to do is to talk about Vietnam in three ways. The first way is Vietnam as a war. And I think, for the most part, this is how Vietnam has been remembered in the United States and perhaps in most countries of the world for the war that was fought there. And certainly Carl was there himself, was a soldier, saw all kinds of terrible things from which I was spared, but which I've studied a lot as a scholar and as someone who's interested in that history. The second thing we're going to talk about is Vietnam as a country, because there are many Vietnamese people who say, who insist on saying that Vietnam is a country, not a war. And they feel the necessity for saying that because they're aware that, again, for most of the world, when the word Vietnam is said, what immediately is associated with that is war. And the Vietnamese people, having suffered through 40 years of continuous warfare, want to put that behind them and talk about different things. And the third thing we want to talk about is the Vietnam War as a lesson. When the United States invaded Iraq and Afghanistan, many of the conversations about these invasions were about whether or not the United States had learned any lessons from the Vietnam War. And by that, people meant both negative and positive lessons. On the one hand, maybe we should not get involved in Iraq and Afghanistan because of the lessons we should have learned in Vietnam. On the other hand, maybe we can conduct better wars in Iraq and Afghanistan because of the lessons that we have learned. And I think, for me, the theme of this conference, narrating war, is really pertinent to all of these issues, mm-hmm. because the issue of narration, of telling stories, of interpreting what has happened to Americans and Vietnamese people is so incredibly important. It's an important way for people to cope with their past and to turn the past into something useful right. for the present. And I know that you spent 30 years working on this novel, Matterhorn, which is an incredible achievement. And I guess my question to you is did writing that book help you cope with the past and what you had gone through?
Oh, absolutely. I had said it Thursday night, this expression of turning ghosts into ancestors, and ghosts haunt you, and if you don't get conscious of your experiences, they remain in your unconscious. And, you know, I mean, it was Carl Jung that said that everything that is unconscious will be manifested in a way that you have no control over. And I think that to a large extent, it even goes into foreign policy. But getting the images and the memories, I mean, it's fiction, but it's clearly based on my experience, out onto a piece of paper is important because now it's separated from my interior. It's now exterior. And it was, you know, I mean, my wife will always joke, she would know when she said, "You're in another battle scene, aren't you?" Because she wouldn't get any sleep that night, because mm-hmm. I'd be kicking and, you know, like this, you know, and she'd know right away what was going on in the book. Mm-hmm. So it clearly did have a cathartic element to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, you brought up ghosts, which I think is really important, because sociologist Avery Gordon has an argument where she says the appearance of ghosts is a sign that something unjust has happened to these people who became ghosts. Yeah. And the ghost appears to demand that we do something about that injustice. And I think telling stories, narrating what happened is a way of addressing that injustice. That, mm-hmm. you know, 58,000 Americans died, 3 million Vietnamese people from all different sides died during the war, and so many of their experiences have been forgotten. So many of their demises were unjust.
Yeah.
And so it begs for stories to be told, yeah. you know. And that's one of the powerful things about the American version of the Vietnam War in literature is that I think so many former soldiers have tried to do justice, I think, to
right.
their comrades.
And I think that there is an advantage for writers being in America as opposed to Vietnam, because I know that some Vietnamese writers have written wonderful books, mm-hmm. and they haven't been very popular with the Vietnamese government. And so I would imagine there is a bit of a lid on telling true experiences. I mean, Bao Ninh, you know, and talked about his experiences very truthfully and was, I think, came under suspicion and some restriction. And I can't remember the woman's name, the diary of the woman doctor.
Deng Nhat Cham.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And that was another piece of writing that actually was very close to the bone and very close to the truth. But I think that, you tell me, you've visited there. I mean, would a struggling artist actually go like, I'm gonna buck the government? You know, I mean, that's not easy. It's right. hard enough bucking New York publishers.
Right. Yeah. But the doctor's name, actually, I got it wrong, is Dak Thuy Trâm.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, when Bao Ninh wrote his book, the opening of the book, The Sorrow of War, which many people consider to be the best of the Vietnamese war novels from a North Vietnamese perspective, it opens up in the jungle of screaming souls. The war is over, but his character, his job is to collect corpses, is to find the missing in action.
Right.
And so the novel is replete with ghosts who are demanding to be heard.
Yeah.
And that's true for the other well-known Vietnamese writer who's written about the war, Yung Thu Hung.
Mm-hmm.
She wrote Novel Without a Name and a number of other works where the ghosts of the past are filling these works. And you're right, to be a Vietnamese writer who wants to bring up these issues, if you bring up the dead, the problem is, it is a problem of justice. With a million dead on the North Vietnamese side, the Vietnamese have a right to ask, was mm-hmm. it just
right.
what they died for? And they look at the contemporary state of the Vietnamese country, and they see that there's a lot of hypocrisy, political and economic corruption happening. The Communist Party that led the revolution and asked the people to sacrifice so much is now the one holding power
right.
and, you know, keeping people down.
Yeah. One of the interesting things, friends of mine who have gone to Vietnam, and I think this is an interesting difference between the way they look at the war and the way we look at the war, is to America, it's like the Vietnam War, and, you know, the 60s, and it still looms very large in our consciousness and in our rather short history, just percentage-wise. But my friends come back and they say they're talking to the Vietnamese and there's this sort of puzzlement about why this is such a big deal, because it's like, well, let's see, we fought the Chinese for 300 years and we fought the French for 60 years. And what were you guys, 10?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it's just sort of like, they've been at war a long time. Mm-hmm. And so it must be a different perspective.
You know, one of the interesting things is that Americans of your generation, when you go back, people automatically assume they're veterans, even if they're not. But anyway, the point is that Vietnamese people really do, for the most part, extend open arms to these Americans and say, you know, we should reconcile, we're friends now, all of that is in the past. But that's not true for the relationships between Vietnamese people. So, you know, the war was fought between North and South Vietnam and between Southern Vietnamese people, different ideological beliefs. A couple of million of these Southern Vietnamese people fled overseas after the end of the war because they didn't want to live under communism. When they go, the relationships are very fraught between these Vietnamese exiles and the Vietnamese at home, which makes sense. For us, it was not just a revolutionary war, but a civil war.
Absolutely.
And civil wars breed very bitter feelings that are very hard to leave behind.
Well, our own civil war, I don't think that the feelings have yet died. Mm-hmm. There are still people who are fighting the cause, and you know, which was a historical interpretation that was done by Southerners after the war was over. It's still mm-hmm. in our literature. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it's just really, really interesting. I thought it would be interesting to play off this idea of the Civil War. If you could talk a little about your community in Southern California, which to me must be very similar to the Cuban community in Florida, and what you were raised in a community that was of one persuasion.
I mean basically the Vietnamese community you find in the United States is historically a very deeply anti-communist mm-hmm. population. I don't think it's quite the same as in Berlin or in Paris, where there are more Vietnamese who came from the north, for example, but it's very anti-communist in the United States. And the United States has the largest Vietnamese population outside of Vietnam, and in Southern California, you have the largest of Vietnamese population of all, and they basically dominate the politics of their community in Orange County. And it's very hard to speak in public about the war or about Vietnam today or about Vietnamese politics if you don't adopt an anti-communist point of view. So it is very much like the anti-Castro Cubans in Florida, where if you want to participate in the public life of the Cuban-American community, you have to speak in a certain conservative fashion, which leaves a huge, you know, proportion of the population, at least in the Vietnamese-American population, without a voice, because they, you know, we want to negotiate, we want to reconcile, we want to have a more complex relationship.
What about
with
the young people? I mean, you were born when the war was just going on, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, but say someone who was born 1990 mm-hmm. on, do they still have the same issue of we're on this side? And
I think it's a very mixed response. I think many of them are like other Americans. They don't care about the past. They don't care about
Vietnam. They become Americanized.
They become American. But there are a certain number, I think, who are subject to what the writer W.G. Sebald calls secondhand memories. Mm-hmm. That is, they never lived through the war. They have no living memories. But they grew up with parents or within an ethnic community that remembered the war constantly through everyday conversations or rituals, public parades. They themselves feel anti-communist. They themselves feel that they lost their country that they never were born in.
I understand that so well because on my mother's side, my relatives are Finns. And when I grew up, I thought the Winter War against Russia was fought next door. You know, I mean, it was like the whole Finnish community was just in the air all the time. Oh yeah, the Russians and the Finns and ski troops and, you know, I mean, that was when I was just this big. And so it is interesting how that continued.
I think it's also true for Americans whose parents lived through the war era. I mean, I don't know if this is true for your children, but I've encountered many Americans who were born after the war who would say, well, you know, I am still affected by it because of what happened to my father and you know, what he, you know, how he behaved at home, for example, or in many, many different kinds
of
traumas.
Or the children of veterans. But I have to tell this story because it is more about American culture than about Vietnam, but it gives you an idea of how the war is viewed. I think Europeans probably have no, maybe some do, clear understanding of just how unhistorical Americans are. My own daughter, I have five children, and the youngest of them was in high school, in a very good suburban high school. I mean, you know, good money, all that sort of stuff. And I asked her one day when she was studying American history toward the end of the year, I said, well, have you studied the Vietnam War? And she got this blank look on her face, you know. And I mean, she got into the engineering school at the University of Washington. She's not dumb, you know. And I said, well, what? She said, I don't know. You know. So I saw her principal at a track meet, because my daughter runs, and I went over to her and I said, well, you know, Devin says that you guys don't study the Vietnam War in history. And she looks at me and says, oh no, way too controversial. It's American high school.
Absolutely true.
Yeah.
You know, Tim O'Brien wrote a book called The Things They Carried about his experiences during the war, which has become a classic now of American literature. It's being taught in American high schools.
Right.
So many students read this book, but when they come to my class, they say, well, you know, we don't study it in the context of the Vietnam War. We study it in the context of storytelling, because the book is very much about how to tell stories. And I think that's what Vietnam has become for many Americans. It's a story.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a story that they had, that has been passed on to them. And they're very passive in accepting what that story means.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, so it's important to control that story. And I think that's why the telling of stories about Vietnam in the United States, of the Vietnam War, has been so important, because it has allowed the United States or American culture to contain the meaning of the Vietnam War, to shape its energies in a certain way. You know, by 1975, the United States was deeply divided about what had happened. But I think by now, I think a large portion of the American population has reconciled itself with the Vietnam War and wants to forget all those divisions and disagreements, and to think of it as a noble failure rather than, you know, an act of aggression.
Yeah. I understand. What is also interesting to me is that it was very prevalent in when you heard about foreign policy. It's like, you know, well, we don't want to do another Vietnam up until around the 80s, late 80s or something. And then it was sort of like started to sort of the drumbeat of, well, we don't want to have this Vietnam syndrome because it's a drag on foreign policy. And what really is interesting to me is that the prevailing myth of what structures foreign policy, as far as I can tell, is Munich, mm-hmm. not Vietnam. In other words, it's like, you give them, if you give in a little bit now, you're going to get World War III. Mm-hmm. So you never do that. So they harken back to, you know, Chamberlain and Munich. And it's sort of Vietnam is just sort of skipped. Mm-hmm. And there's probably a couple reasons for it. One is that, you know, that's not a very popular war. We lost it, you know. So whereas World War II, you know, we won that. So, I mean, so maybe that's why that stays. But it's really interesting. You hear people talking about nuclear weapons in Iran. Mm-hmm. What comes up?
Mm-hmm.
Munich. You know.
The reason I find this whole topic interesting is because for people who live through a historical experience as traumatic as the Vietnam War was, whether they were Americans or Vietnamese, there's a real sense that, you know, you should never forget these things. Mm-hmm. You should always remember. These are cliches,
right.
But they hang on to that idea. But what history seems to be teaching us is that people will forget even the worst kinds of things, or find ways to remember them in that would allow them to use it for their own purposes.
Yeah.
So, you know, we see it happening with World War II in terms of, you know, how Japan and China are thinking about resurrecting old tensions. In the era of Vietnam, it also seems like the Vietnam War is, again, just becoming something that Americans can leave behind in the history books and not take it as a lesson for not getting involved overseas.
Yeah. It triggers something else in my mind about getting involved. I look at the Vietnam War as a mistake. I think it was a policy error. I don't ascribe imperialist designs or that there was oil in the South China Sea. To me, it looked like a bunch of World War II veterans who were in charge, Kennedy, McNamara. These people had a mindset of stopping world domination by dictators. I mean, that was sort of their mindset, and that was their myth. And they viewed communism as just one more of those. And so here comes Munich. We can't allow them to go one step further in Vietnam. And I don't know if the way they viewed it was as a war of aggression. I think that they viewed it as containment, and that's why they went in. But I think that they were wrong because, I mean, it wasn't monolithic communism. I mean, the Vietnamese were had been fighting the Chinese and are very different than Chinese, and certainly Yugoslavia, you know, wasn't monolithic communism, and so they just made an error that way. But what's interesting, you and I had talked about this, and I think it would be interesting for you to talk about it, is if you looked at the situation today, China, Vietnam, the Philippines, Singapore, Japan, it looks like it's just starting up again. Right. I mean,
mm-hmm. Right. So, I mean, that's one of the ironies of this entire war was the United States went in, the rhetoric was containment, domino theory, stopping communism before it went all the way to Latin America and into the United States.
They're coming to a shopping mall near you.
Exactly. And now, you know, the irony of it is that Vietnam has essentially become a capitalist country,
right,
ruled by a communist party, and it has become, it's trying to figure out whether it wants to be a U.S. ally. It's trying to figure out who it's more afraid of, the United States or China. The answer is probably going to be China.
Yeah.
And, you know, the United States is negotiating with all of these Southeast Asian countries to contain China in the East China Sea. And that's essentially what was happening, almost essentially what was happening,
yeah,
in the 1950s and the 1960s. And I guess the point of this is that Vietnamese feelings, I think, are divided on this issue. If you ask the Vietnamese in the United States, many of them would say the war in Vietnam was a good war to defend their freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And that getting involved in Iraq and Afghanistan is also a good war, good wars, because it's an extension of the same need to defend freedom. But for many, you know, Vietnamese people in Vietnam, I think they do see it. They did see the war as an act of imperialist aggression.
Of course.
They did see it as a deliberate attempt by the United States to control their country for American interests. But the irony is that now it's let bygones be bygones. You know, we can be friends, and instead, yeah, we'll be unified around capitalism and containing China.
Right. Yeah. It just sort of goes full circle, and I assume at some point there's going, if China decides to, you know, take over those abandoned rocks between Japan and wherever, I can't remember the name of them, those islands, but then suddenly there's going to be a decision have to be made, and there we are. It's 1955 or 1960 again, and I kind of have this, I don't know, sense of, what is it, what Yogi Berra said, it's deja vu all over again.
Yeah. The islands, I think, are called the Spratlys or the Paracels. Maybe they're both. But,
yeah.
I wanted to change the topic a little bit, you know, and say that when I was reading your first book, the novel, Matterhorn, one of the things that struck me was that you, it's focused entirely on the American experience, but you do talk about the enemy that you encounter, the mm-hmm. North Vietnamese soldiers that you're fighting against. And the character in your novel makes it a point to stress that he respects the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
They're at war, but he respects the enemy. And I think this was very interesting because when I was growing up, I read a lot of American literature of the war, and I don't think that was actually a common response. I mean, yes, they respected the enemy, but they were also calling them gooks
mm-hmm.
at the same time. So as a young Vietnamese-American growing up, I felt very divided. As I was an American reading this literature, identifying with American soldiers,
mm-hmm.
on the other hand, I was the gook that they
right.
were talking about.
Yeah.
So in your book, I think that doesn't happen. I don't really, I mean, I think they're called gooks and so on, but...
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's what they were called.
Yeah, you don't draw back on the racial terminology.
Yeah.
But it's very deliberate, I think, on your part to also stress that it was really a respected enemy. And I think that's an important narrating strategy.
Mm-hmm.
That you're using. I don't know, could you have done that 30 years when you first started in the 1970s? Do you think you could have done that? Or did it really take 30 years of distance to get to that point?
No. I actually did start it in the 1970s, just that no one would publish it. So that was, you know, and it was good because if it had gotten published, I mean, my first draft I wrote in my late 20s, and although I thought I was a completely grown-up person when I was 29 years old, I'm afraid that now my perspective is I was not. So the book got better and better. But no, I mean, I was a Marine, and Marines are you know, elite troops, and we, generally speaking, had a lot of respect for the North Vietnamese Army. I mean, even today, Marines, older Marines, the old Corps, as we call ourselves now, we'll talk to young Marines, and it'll be things like, yeah, if the NVA had been defending Baghdad, you'd still be fighting for mm-hmm. it. Because it not only is a tribute to a very professional Army, they were really good,
But it's also the bigger your enemy, the bigger you are. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of a lot of that as well. And I think that the issue of gook, which is universal, towelhead, Haji, fascist pig, commie pinko, nigger. I mean, every culture does this. And again, I talked a little bit about it before. It's the only way that decent 19-year-old kids can pull the trigger. Mm-hmm. It's a way of distancing yourself. And it's like, then if the other person is an animal and an animal's trying to kill me and trying to kill my friends, well, then by golly, I will pull the trigger. It breaks down. Mm-hmm. I mean, I wrote about it in the second book where it breaks down. And then you do have to deal with the fact that you did pull the trigger and a human being died. Mm-hmm. And I think there's something about the way that you have to sort of see wars that is changing. The way we are genetically, I think, built, certainly men, is to defend their tribe. And if you have a sense that you're defending your people, then the sense of moral problems, the sense of guilt, is nowhere near as high as if it's sort of complicated. And Vietnam was, I think, the first time it really got obscure. You can explain to a 19-year-old in World War II that they hit us at Pearl Harbor, killed 2,500 of us, sunk a bunch of our ships, and they are going to be on the coast, you know, very soon, unless we do something. I get it. Let's go to war. We'll fight it. Korea, they crossed this line. We're going to push him back. Now, MacArthur decided to push farther than he should have, but he got fired, which I think was appropriate. But Vietnam was the first time it was like the 19-year-old, you know, are the North Vietnamese really going to invade Santa Monica? Mm-mm. I don't think so. I mean, it was possible that the Japanese would, so you get it. But that was a war that it was like, well, we're doing it for domino theory and containment. And let's face it, I mean, most 19-year-olds don't give a crap about that. I mean, they don't want to hear it, you know. So you couldn't explain it. What ended up happening, and I think this was a moral issue, is that they've been measuring that war by body count because there were no clear objectives.
And for me, that one way to interpret that is it's a failure of storytelling.
Yeah,
to build a story around the body count of counting dead bodies is not a very good storytelling technique. It's horrifying.
Story. Yeah.
Whereas with World War II, we call it the Good War in the United States, which obscures so many things.
Right.
But it's a triumph of storytelling that the American people and much of the world was persuaded that this was a just war, and that capacity to narrate justice failed for Americans during the Vietnam War, and the ones who won were the North Vietnamese.
Right.
Because they set out with a very deliberate propaganda strategy to persuade the rest of the world and much of the American people that their story was the correct one, that Americans were imperialist aggressors against these heroic, noble, suffering, self-sacrificing Vietnamese people. And that's the image that much of the world had of the Vietnamese.
Where was Don Draper when we needed him?
Right. But one irony of that is, people want to know about the North Vietnamese experience or about the heroic revolutionaries from Vietnam. What they don't want to know about, for the most part, are the South Vietnamese, the ones who fought, that you went there as a Marine ostensibly to fight with the South Vietnamese for their freedom.
Right.
And from my reading of the American literature and culture of the war, the irony was that many of the American soldiers held the South Vietnamese in contempt. Mm-hmm. They were losers. They were not good soldiers. They were not willing to fight for their own freedoms. And this translated in the United States into a real reluctance to hear the stories of South Vietnamese people.
Yeah, I think that there's a pretty good explanation for that, at least my explanation, which I'll say is good. There was always this myth that was built up bigger than it was that, well, the South Vietnamese won't stand and fight with you. They'll leave you there by yourself. We have the same issue going on in Afghanistan today. And of course, we always used to joke about it. we're out of here in 13 months. The South Vietnamese Army is going to be here until forever, you know. So why would they stick their necks out the way that we could, because we're going to get it, go home? The other one is, of course, that there was no opportunity for the North Vietnamese to ever prove that they were going to run out on you, because they were the enemy. So if one or two units left from South Vietnam, and let's face it, every army has units that don't operate up to snuff, then that mythology can build. And it was impossible for the North, because they were our enemy. The other one is, who do you blame? You're 19, you're 18, and I think it's hard for people to understand. I was the second oldest in my entire company of Marines, over 200 Marines, and I turned 23. And the company commander, who was a USC graduate, was also 23 years old. And everybody else was all these grizzled, tough sergeants. They're 19, 8-year-old kids. So who do they blame? They can't sort of blame Lyndon Johnson, you know. I mean, they can't blame, you know, domino theory. Well, we must be here helping these guys. Well, Christ, you know, these are the guys we have to blame. So I think you have two things going against you. And it did develop into that sort of sense of looking down on South Vietnamese. But when you look back at the history of their warfare, absolutely noble, brave troops with occasional lapses. Hello, every army in the world has that, you know.
So you can see why for the Vietnamese in exile, whether they're in France or Germany or the United States, the need to tell their own stories is so important, because they know that they are overshadowed in the world's memory by the stories that Americans have told and the stories that North Vietnamese or Vietnamese communists have told. So for them, the war is a double loss, or a triple loss, let's say. They lost the war, they lost their country, and then they've lost the ability to tell their own stories, to shape their own public faces. And I think for many Vietnamese in exile or Vietnamese refugees, that's a very traumatic experience for them. And it's something that they haven't been able to overcome in the way that some American veterans have been, because at least American veterans have the opportunity to either tell their story or to have it told by people like you, who come in to, because you stand in to a certain extent as a representative for a certain kind of American soldier's experience. And it's incredibly important how stories are so incredibly important in letting people feel that their lives have been acknowledged.
But you know what's interesting is why? Because there are how many Vietnamese in America? I mean,
a couple million.
Yeah. Okay, out of a couple million, there's going to be a few good writers. And one sitting here, what is it that inhibits? Because there's clearly enough storytelling ammunition. I mean, the North Vietnamese were no angels. And they came into villages and did horrible, horrible things. And so there's certainly storytelling to counter the image of the brave little people in black pajamas fighting the imperialists, you know, from the sky. But why not?
Well, my feeling is, I think of it as there's not only a military-industrial complex in the United States. There's a Hollywood-industrial complex.
Yes.
They work arm-in-arm.
Tinseltown.
It's the same, the same technology that allows you to go and kill a million people is related to the technology that allows you to make a $300 million movie. How many countries in the world can do that?
Right.
So ironically, even though the United States lost the war, they've won the war on film. And those are the stories that circulate globally. The Vietnam's leading revolutionary director, Dung Nhat Minh, he made a film about that Vietnamese doctor. And the film was released, and just by the way, her diary, she was killed by American troops in 1972 when she was 26. Her diary was recovered by an American officer who came back 20-something years later to give the diary to her family. And then they published it in Vietnam. It became a huge bestseller. So then Dung Nhat Minh makes a film based on that book, and he says it opened on the same weekend in Vietnam as Transformers 2. And he said, that was a monster, and my film was a bicycle.
Right.
But likewise, within the context of wherever the Vietnamese refugee or diasporic community finds itself, whether it's, again, here in Germany or in the United States or France or Australia, they are overwhelmed, I think. They're overpowered by the culture that they live in.
Yeah.
Especially people of your age. You know, they may speak some English, but they can't write their own stories in English.
Yeah.
So they struggle with that inability to know that their stories are being acknowledged, first of all, by the country that they live in, but they also fear that their children won't know their own stories. And that creates such intense loss mm-hmm. and despair sometimes within families.
But what's interesting, you say, you talk about the Hollywood machine and telling, you know, the story of Vietnam, yet the actual prevailing story is what you start out with, mm-hmm. which is the North Vietnamese story, mm-hmm. in spite of the fact that they don't have, I mean, I would guess that story has never been countered effectively. Mm-hmm.
You know, my thinking, though, is, you know, when you watch American movies like Apocalypse Now, Deer Hunter, Full Metal Jacket, Platoon, I think these are world-famous movies. Mm-hmm. Even people in Vietnam have seen these movies, and they like some of them, too. Mm-hmm. But the point there is that even though many of these movies cast American soldiers in a bad light for doing terrible things, my thinking is it's better to be an anti-hero than not to be in the movies at all.
That's interesting.
I show my students Apocalypse Now, in which, you know, Vietnamese people are killed at a massive rate. And I said, would you rather be the soldier doing the killing on screen, or would you rather be the Vietnamese person? They'd rather be the soldier killing on screen.
Right.
Right? Yeah. Who wants to be the victim? You would rather be the victimizer as long as it meant that you were at the center of the stage having your story told. Yeah. That's one of the ironies of the end of the war.
Yeah, it is very interesting.
Yeah. So have you been back to Vietnam?
No, I haven't. And it's interesting because if I went to Vietnam, to me personally, it would be like going to a new country. Mm-hmm. People say, what's Vietnam like? As far as I was concerned, it was like going into a beautiful national forest where the rangers shot at you. But I literally was put on a Continental Airlines, you know, airliner with stewardesses serving us peanuts and Coke, because none of us were old enough to drink. I was one of them that was old enough to drink. But and then I was in a helicopter, and I was dropped into the mountains where the border of Laos meets what was then the demilitarized zone, and never saw a friendly Vietnamese, never saw a friendly Vietnamese village. So what's interesting about the war is there are so many different angles. I mean, somebody that fought that war in the Mekong Delta, or somebody who fought that war in and amongst the villages, the way that wars in Afghanistan and certainly in Iraq were being fought, it's very different than the one that I was fighting. Ours was very, you could almost say, a professional war. Mm-hmm. Marines against NVA elite troops. And we just duked it out up there. I never saw anything, so it's interesting.
So yours, in many ways, was a conventional kind of war story.
Very,
right? Very clear-cut lines, yeah, between our side, their side.
Yeah.
You know, in my class, I have on the Vietnam War and American and memory, I have my students interview people who have survived the war, and they interview a lot of American, former American soldiers. Mm-hmm. And a lot of those guys never saw any fighting. They were sitting on a ship.
Sure.
They were in the rear lines somewhere. And my impression is that that's actually the majority experience.
You know, I think that somebody said something like in the Army in Vietnam, 12% actually were in the infantry. Mm-hmm. Now, the Marines had a much higher percentage, but they're a much, much smaller organization than the Army because the Navy does all their support. But today it's even more, or the ratio is even less. If you think about, you have pilot in a helicopter, which you didn't have in World War II, it probably takes hundreds of people to keep that helicopter supplied with gasoline and or JP4 and operating. And I mean, just think of the logistics. And so the vast, vast majority of soldiers are only involved in being, you know, taken under fire if they happen to get in a truck and move from A to B, mm-hmm. but they're not fighting. You know, it's really different.
That to me is very interesting because obviously when we think of war stories, we think of what you just talked about in terms of shooting and the enemy and combat and all that, young men mm-hmm. being tested by fire. And yet, what's also interesting, and I'm fascinated by that, but what's also interesting to me is the banality. Yeah. Of the stories that can be encompassed under the idea of the war story.
Well, you know, somebody has to cook the burgers at right. McDonald's at the forward operating base, you know, in Fallujah or whatever it is. And that is the absolute majority. There's a wonderful book called FOBIT, mm-hmm. Forward Operating Base, FOB, is a FOB. And the people that live and work in these things are called by the actual fighting troops, FOBITs, after hobbits. And this guy, he actually was a publicity writer He worked, he was an army, career army sergeant, and he wrote, he figured out how to write stories to send to, you know, newspapers back home and to the, you know, the AP to spin whatever was going on. And so he wrote a novel based on, it's called Fobbett. And it actually is the novel about the most ordinary experience. Mm-hmm. It's kind of interesting. And it's a good book.
And I think the banality of war is actually what's more problematic than the terror of war, because people are perfectly willing to give you their time to hear about the terror of war and war is hell and all that. But I'll give you an example. The American writer Maxine Hong Kingston, she wrote a book called Chinamen, and in that there's a chapter there called The Brother in Vietnam. So her brother has to go to Vietnam. He serves on a Navy ship, and his really only purpose is to push a button. Mm-hmm. But she says, well, you know, that's a dangerous thing. You're pushing a button to do what? To drop a bomb. Or she says, connect it to what's happening in the United States. She has a long passage where she says, every time I open the refrigerator or eat Wonder Bread or use something from ITT, I'm helping to service the war machine. She's trying to point out that this is a war story too.
Yes.
The banality of civilian rear line complicity that makes a war possible. So we're sending young 19-year-olds, 23-year-olds to go fight a war, and they're paying the price with their bodies and spirits. But the entire American population, she's saying, is enabling that to happen.
Absolutely.
And that's what people don't want to recognize. They don't want to hear that story being told.
No, because then you have to take responsibility.
Yeah.
I'm on that all the time, that somehow at the end of this long chain of, you know, teachers and farmers and financiers and, you know, da 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 da, that builds the weapon, the 19-year-old pulls the trigger, but as far as the, not just America, but the whole world is concerned, he's the one that did the killing. Mm-hmm. He was actually, you know, certainly part of it, but mm-hmm. he was right at the very end of a very long chain. And I think that's an issue of consciousness that we just haven't gotten to yet, and there's a lot of reasons why. Just think about the way that the war has been financed in America. We've borrowed the money from the Chinese. Well, there's nothing on the tax form that says, okay, here's the taxes you pay for, you know, roads and dams and, you know, welfare and stuff. And then, surcharge for fighting in Afghanistan and Iraq, $3,800. You believe people would suddenly mm-hmm. start, what? Mm-hmm. $3,500 mm-hmm. for that? What mm-hmm. are we doing over there? Mm-hmm. It's not there. Mm-hmm. And the second thing, which I think is very bad for a republic, a democracy, is that it's being fought basically by a very, very small minority of the population, and a tiny number of those are from elites. I mean, mm-hmm. how many kids from Stanford, Yale, Harvard even go into the military mm-hmm. today? None. In 1940, I mean, at Yale, I was at Yale, and there's a big, big, giant plaque in Wolseley Hall, and it's bigger than this stage, of the names of dead Yaleys who died in World War I, World War II, and Korea. None. One Yaley died in Vietnam, mm-hmm. Biff Fulberth, who was a Marine, and from then on, none. Mm-hmm. Why is it that the American people are sort of, you know, blasé about it? They don't have any skin in the game. Mm-hmm. That's mm-hmm. why. It's real simple, and I think they ought to.
Well, I think also that American writers have failed the American people in terms of telling stories that would force the American people to confront some of these things that you're talking about. It's easier to write the more conventional kind of war story, let's say, or just to write about something else altogether. So my take on it is we're always asking writers from other countries to reveal to their people the terrible oppression that they suffer under their government. So we love it when Chinese writers speak against communism, for right. example, and we will turn these Chinese writers into heroes. But for me, when I look at American literature, I don't think we have that same encouragement to tell for American writers to become dissidents against their own wars, to become dissidents against these vast apparatuses of finance and warfare that you've talked about.
Because it's sort of, you know, all good novels have to have protagonists and antagonists. Mm-hmm. But if your antagonist is a pillow that you go like this at and nothing happens, mm-hmm. that's not a good story. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's the nature of the beast yeah. is that it's so amorphous. Mm-hmm. In Vietnam, you could protest. Mm-hmm. So there were stories, mm-hmm. and there were lots of them, mm-hmm. you know, movies and everything mm-hmm. about anti-war right. themes. because you could actually stand up and say something. But when it is just sort of as amorphous mm-hmm. as it is, there isn't a story there. And my contention is that is the job for nonfiction writers, historians, mm-hmm. academics, simply because what novel are you going to write about the military-industrial complex? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like, I'd have a hard time coming up with
right.
a good one.
Right.
Because quite frankly, I don't believe there's a conspiracy.
Right.
I don't
Here's
believe
where
it,
we,
I don't
we disagree.
Yeah, yeah, we do. He's more cynical than I am. But I mean, I don't believe the Trilateral Commission mm-hmm. is out there manipulating people, puppets mm-hmm. with strings. I think it's so completely amorphous mm-hmm. And so intertwined mm-hmm. that there's no target. Mm-hmm. You know, and I just, you know, you can't name the names right. of the bad guys.
Right, right. But I think that there is that connection then. In American literature, I think there is real encouragement to tell stories about individuals.
Yes.
You want faces, you want names, you want clear-cut stories, antagonists, and so on. And so that's why I think the more conventional war stories are acceptable to audiences. Even if it's an anti-war story, it still tells a story in a way that they can recognize narratively and feel pleasure in
yeah.
by identifying with someone. And like you're saying, how do you tell a story about systems and
yeah,
complexes?
It may just be a limit of literature, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. and that's, I mean, you know, even, you know, I'm happy to admit that my field may just not be able to cover all mm-hmm. the bases, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. We yeah. try as best as we can. Yeah.
So we were thinking that maybe we would have time to take some questions from the audience.
It's like going to the second grade class, you know. Johnny, you must have a question.
wenn es Fragen gibt,
if there are questions, please feel free.
Oder Kommentare.
Or comments.
Bitte.
auf Deutsch oder auf Englisch?
If someone would translate.
Yeah. I will, whatever you prefer, I would be ready to translate. Gerne, aber ich... Gerne auf Deutsch oder auf Englisch, wie Sie
okay,
mögen.
Okay, try in English.
Ich würde das dann auf übersetzen.
My impression of this talk and of other talks as well during this fabulous conference is that the Vietnam War and other wars that are more in the past are here very much on the front. But I read your book and I was absolutely thrilled about it. But I'd like you to elaborate a little bit on your thoughts about this modern wars now, and maybe the difference that we can see mm-hmm. coming from, for example. Technological improvements of the weapons, drones,
right?
Yeah, and what it does to the soldiers, A, and B, what it does to our experience of the war. My impression is we are talking about asymmetrical wars. Non-symmetric wars that meant that suicidal attacks mm-hmm. come to an army or so, Israel and other regions in the world as an example. But now we have contra-asymmetrical wars where drones, like machines, mm-hmm. come to suicidal attackers, killing those, and this is a problem.
I think it is
For us taking the story. What's happening yeah. there? What kind of war, and how can we cope with this? Well, how can we?
I think you asked a whole bunch of questions in there, but I'll start with the issue of drones. First of all, it has always been the case that weapons technology has always outdistanced consciousness. And every introduction of a new weapon has been faced with moral dilemmas. When the crossbow was invented, 1200, 1300, knights would hang crossbowmen for using it because they said it was unfair that the crossbowmen could stand back and shoot at them without any fear of retaliation. So it was a criminal act. And so in one sense, drones, the Air Force, I think, likes to call them remotely piloted aircraft. I love it. Remotely piloted aircraft is just another extension of being able to strike your enemy from a greater and greater distance away. What is changed about that is that you can now stay home and live with your wife and family and commute to work with all the other commuters, and they're just in the traffic going to work just like you, and you go to work, and then maybe you kill a couple people that day, and then you drive home and take your kid to soccer practice. That's a huge psychological shift and a very big shift. The other thing is that we now have pretty much come to a position until other people start using these drones, and they will, where it becomes too easy. And this is where, again, the consciousness has to start to catch up. I think consciousness in general between the Soviet Union and the West caught up to the hydrogen bomb. I think people went, whoa, this is too big to use. And luckily, I think we managed to squeak through that one. We still have problems, as you know, with other people not thinking that way. But in general, I think that was a big risk. But what you have today with the drones is that when I was fighting, I did not want to do any extra credit. I mean, if the general said, take the hill, I wasn't going to say, hey, general, let's take another one. Why? Because I could get killed. That is a natural break on violence, is that violence can be done back. And let's leave it alone. Not only that, but you can see the carnage. There is nothing that you can experience like the smell of dead bodies or seeing the dogs eating them. And drone pilots simply are never going to have to be exposed to that. So fear, carnage, the closeness to enemy, all that is being eliminated. And what's also being eliminated is that war is an extraordinary event. Although, I mean, everybody has pointed out, and I totally agree, that it's part of human nature. I mean, wars have been going on continually. Maybe not for one country, but as people have pointed out, any time that you look anywhere in the world, there's a war going on. So it's got to be conceded that it's part of human nature. But I think that when an individual country starts to see it as just ongoing, for example, we have never marked the end of any war since World War II. In America, there was an actual day called VJ Day, Victory Over Japan Day, that was celebrated. And people were out in the street and kissing everybody, and the war was over. Now we go back to normal life. There was no end celebrated for Vietnam, Korea, First Gulf War. The troops are going to come back from Afghanistan as if they've just been on some kind of business trip overseas. There is no longer a sense that this is something extraordinary. And I talk about it in my book. I call it the Temple of Mars, where you actually enter into a space that's different than ordinary life. And so the increasing technology is going to require an increasing speeding up of our consciousness of how it's used. And if not, it becomes too easy. There's not even any political blowback. The president can order a drone strike, and since nobody's hurt on our side, there's no political consequence.
I just want to talk about the fact that the perspective of the people who are getting bombed. In Bout Ninh's A Sorrow of War, he talks about how the Americans were bombing Hanoi, and hospitals were burning, and people were dying. And the narrator of the book says, this is when I decided to go to war. This is when my whole generation decided to sacrifice itself
and torrents of blood would flow because of American bombing. You know, so Americans have a very deep investment in their technology, in their belief that if they can just keep on refining their technological superiority, they'll be able to win wars. And they went into Vietnam with that belief. I think they're still going into that belief with this drone weapon. Mm-hmm. But the perspective of how people experience being bombed or fired upon from a distance is, like you said, with the example of the knights and the crossbow guys, they're mad. They think this is a criminal action being inflicted upon them.
They're angry.
So they may be killed, but they're not going
to
stop fighting.
What's fascinating to me is that there is so much evidence about how bombing just does nothing but steal the will of the people being bombed. World War II, the German nation was under, horrible bombing. The British in London, you know, and did they suddenly say, oh, stop bombing us, we give up? No. Yeah. It made them more intransigent. Yeah. So I think that the other thing I think that is really important to try and understand, and it's a difficult thing, and I know it's not understood in America, is that you have warriors, and a warrior is somebody that chooses sides, and they're willing to risk their life, and they're willing to inflict violence on people. And then you have police. The police are willing to inflict violence, and they're willing to put their lives and their limbs at risk, but they cannot choose sides. The police have to be on the side of the law. And the way you train people and the type of people you have, I would never want to go to war with a bunch of 35-year-olds. You know, I mean, they'd be like, whoa, Lieutenant, geez, let's think about this for a while. I mean, God, I got a better idea. Why don't we do this? You know, a 19-year-old is the ideal person for a warrior. You just go do it. He's the worst possible person for a police. You need 35, 40-year-old people to be police. And what are we doing? We're sending 19-year-olds into police roles now. I mean, that's what's going on. And they're unequipped for it. And even if they were 40-year-old mature police, what law are they enforcing? Sharia law, Western European law, Afghan? I mean, it's a mess because there's no clear idea about what we're actually doing. And I think that has to start to get sorted out.
Well, Carl, I'd like to thank you for participating in this dialogue with me, and to thank the audience and the House of World Culture for having us tonight.
Yeah. Thank you.
1 minute.
Vielen herzlichen Dank. Now we can leave. Okay. I think we can step off here.